Missouri School of Journalism. Welcome to Global Journalist. I'm Jason McClure. When the Soviet Union collapsed in 1991, there was much international concern about the security of its nuclear weapons and stockpiles of nuclear material. And while the worst fears of Soviet fissile material being acquired by terrorists or rogue states haven't materialized, that doesn't mean the legacy of the Soviet Union's nuclear program is an entirely happy one. Now, two former Soviet nuclear sites in particular have had lasting impacts on the people who live near them. One of them is Chernobyl in Ukraine. Chernobyl, of course, is well known globally for the 1986 meltdown of its number 4 reactor and received new attention this year after HBO released a miniseries based on the disaster. The other site has received much less attention. That's the Soviet Union's former testing ground for nuclear weapons in the Central Asian nation of Kazakhstan. There, more than 400 thermonuclear blasts took place both above and below ground over an area about the size of New Jersey. So on this edition of Global Journalist, a look at the legacy of the Soviet Union's nuclear program and two parts of the former empire more than 1,700 miles apart. So we'll talk first about Chernobyl, and for that we're pleased to be joined by two journalists based in Europe for the U.S.-backed Radio Free Asia, Radio Liberty, or RFERL as it's known. Joining us from Kiev in Ukraine is RFERL journalist Tetyana Yakubovich. Tetyana, welcome.
Hello, everyone.
And also with us in Prague in the Czech Republic is Alex Znadkevich. He's a multimedia producer for RFERL's Belarus service. Alex, welcome.
Hi.
Well, Tetyana, if I could start with you, remind us why Chernobyl melted down and who was to blame.
For me, very interesting was the influence of Soviet propaganda, because it totally put the blame on this explosion to Chernobyl staff. And I worked with this topic for 10 years maybe, and finally my main interest was focused on the role of Chernobyl staff. I understood that this was a big Soviet lie and try to do something to change this mind about the that Chernobyl staff was the blame was put on Chernobyl staff on this explosion by propaganda.
Okay, so it was placed on the staff, on the operators in the control room of the nuclear reactor, but in fact this was sort of an unusual design for a nuclear reactor. It was supposed to both generate electricity for the Soviet Union as well as produce weapons grade plutonium for potentially nuclear weapons as well.
Of course, this Chernobyl nuclear power station was a civil building, civil station to produce electricity. Of course, as I understand, the if Soviet system says that the reason of explosion, the cause was the defect of this contraction, is it makes the system weaker. It shows the weakness of system. So this is the reason why these answers appeared, this a version about the big mistake of people appeared. And those people who worked on station, they often could not defend themselves because many of them died. And, you know, when situation changed and this strategy presented in MAGATE was disavowed and changed, this topic of Chernobyl wasn't a sensation already, like in first years after explosions.
And very convenient scapegoats then, in part because many of the people who were operators at the station died. And Alex Znadkevich, if I could bring you in, at the time of the meltdown, there were something like 31 people who died in the explosion or from the release of radioactive gas right afterwards. But there was also sort of longer-term radiation exposure that affected tens of thousands of more people afterwards, and especially in the country you cover, Belarus, which of course the border of Belarus is quite close to Chernobyl in Ukraine. Talk to us about what happened in Belarus immediately after the meltdown at Chernobyl.
Well, first I would like to add to the point that There had been problems with Chernobyl station before this big explosion in 86. There had been some smaller scale problems at the station, and they were covered up. And that's one of the things that came up after the explosion itself, because people were not informed at all about the accident for the first 36 hours. Only after 36 hours people found that something happened. But the full information was hidden from the population for a long time. And one of the reasons why so many children in Belarus, and Belarus suffered the most, because it's close to the Chernobyl nuclear station, is close, it's in Ukraine, but it's close to the border, and the clouds mostly went north. And one of the things that happened after that, the decision was made in Moscow not to allow the clouds to reach Moscow itself and some large cities in Russia. So what they did, and there was a report on BBC, the Russian, the Soviet military pilot named Alexei Grushin, he spoke about how they downed these clouds with radioactive substances on territory of Belarus. The officials in Russia still reject this version, although this Mr. Grushin, he was awarded for military courage. So what happened, the children received high levels of radioactive iodine, because people did not know that during the first days, when the radioactive iodine is the most dangerous, it was necessary to take normal iodine to block the entrance into the system. And for children, it was most dangerous because they have higher levels of metabolism and because they consumed a lot of milk that also...
So this radioactive... This radioactive iodine, then, it sort of traveled from Chernobyl and it precipitated, some of the ash precipitated into Belarus,
yes.
Where, correct me if I'm wrong, cows would actually eat the grass and the radioactivity would become concentrated in the cow's milk, and children would drink it, and many of them wound
that's
up
correct.
With thyroid cancer.
That's correct. And the explosion released, a cocktail of radioactive substances. The most dangerous of those in the first days were... especially iodine, and there was cesium, which has a much longer half-life, and there were some heavier elements which did not travel that long, like plutonium. This iodine was the most dangerous in the first weeks after the explosion. And in Poland, on the 29th of April, which means 3 days after the explosion itself, children were given normal iodine to block radioactive iodine. And in the Soviet Union, people were not informed about this effect until it was probably too late for many children. And the levels of thyroid cancer increased thousandfold. I mean, it's a rare disease, but it was in single numbers at that time. And after the explosion in the first years, it increased to thousands.
Well, Tatiana Yakubovich, if I could ask you, what about in Ukraine then? We just heard Alex talking about how there were thousands, maybe tens of thousands of children who later contracted thyroid cancer as a result of this. Were there similar health problems in Ukraine in the years after Chernobyl?
Of course, health problems are still the point of discussions. Here, many doctors say that there are some aftermath of this explosion, big aftermath, but if you know, there was also one theory of Soviet times that it is not dangerous. There was a professor, I'd forgotten his name, but he was a high-level specialist in Ministry of Health in the Soviet Union, and he made norms of radiation, and these norms were very high. He said that there was no long distance aftermath of high levels of radiations for people. And what I'd like to add that surprisingly for Russia and many people in Russia now, Chernobyl topic is still political topic. They say that new film of HBO is anti-Russian film, and these discussions are now very popular in social media. I also
so the dis- so the, H- the new HBO miniseries then, in other words, has really been fostering this conversation then, and you said it's still a sensitive topic in between Ukraine and Russia.
Of course, and interest to Chernobyl topic, to Chernobyl tourism is rising up now, and also political discussions are rising. Some people say that their argument is in every country can happen mistakes. But when I discuss with such people, I say that it was not mistake, it was false accusation. And this film, the great role of this film is that people began to understand something about the causes. It is a very complicated physics question, but even in this movie, popular movie for a wide audience, people try to understand and began to understand. I think it is a very good and a big progress in understanding of topic of Chernobyl.
Well, Alex Nadkevich, if I could bring you back in, I understand that in Belarus, one of the things that the Soviet Union did in the years after Chernobyl was they moved like tens of thousands, maybe something like 150,000, 200,000 people out of the area where there was radiation exposure. And the Soviets literally came in and burned villages to keep people from going back. And I know that you recently traveled back to this area. I think it's called the Krasnopole region of Belarus. And you found that there are people back in those areas.
Well, first of all, it's one of the small regions that was evacuated, but it's not the only one, and it's not the most contaminated. There are several regions in Belarus that had high level of contamination because of this downing of the clouds, especially, and some of those resulted in the situation when one village would be highly contaminated and the nearby village is not that much. So on the territory of that district that we visited, there were dozens of villages that were evacuated, people left, and most of the buildings were destroyed. But we talked to a couple of guys who left, and they could not, at that time, the older one, the father, could not find a job. So what he did, he basically came back to this village, and now there's no village. It's razed to the ground, and there's only one building there, one, you know.
So people move back into the radiation zone, but what do they say about the danger?
Well, he says it's not dangerous, and we measured the radioactivity and it showed the danger zone and it showed the high levels of radioactivity, but they kind of fatalistic about it. The people who live nearby in a village where the level of radiation is not that high, they have a different problem. They mainly complain of unemployment, and the government does not develop any industries in those regions. So these people have to live on subsistence farming, and it's still dangerous, and they still go to forests and pick up mushrooms and berries, although it's prohibited. But they say, we have no choice. We have to somehow feed ourselves.
Well, Alex Nadkevich, Tatiana Yakubovich, thank you so much for taking the time to join us.
Thank you.
Up next, we're going to turn to Kazakhstan, which was home to the Soviet Union's main testing ground for nuclear weapons during the Cold War. Now, there at a top secret site called Semipalatinsk, the Soviets conducted 456 nuclear tests. They studied things like weapons design and the effect of radiation on plants and animals, even human beings. And there's even a large freshwater lake the Soviets created by detonating a nuclear weapon underground. So for more on what this test site is like today, we're going to bring in two people who have researched it extensively. Joining us from Prague is Harut Mansourian. He's a multimedia producer at Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, and he made a recent documentary report called The Lethal Soviet Legacy in Kazakhstan. Also with us from the city of Karaganda in Kazakhstan is Magdalena Stokowski. She's an assistant professor of anthropology at the University of South Carolina. She spent more than a year living near the nuclear test site in a village and studying its people. So welcome to both of you. If I could start with you, Magdalena Stokowski, talk to us just a little bit about what this part of the world looks like. I understand like you had very free access to the nuclear test zone.
Yes, yes. Well, glad to be here. I do want to say that there are several lakes on the test site itself that were made as a result of detonations. I've lived on the border of the nuclear test site for a while, certainly for a year, but I have been returning ever since 2010. The region there is quite isolated, especially after the fall of the Soviet Union, where a lot of the collective farming collapsed. A lot of people moved out. And today people live, you know, in a region that's quite difficult to get to. From Karaganda, for example, it's about 400 or so kilometers, 180 of which are down along a, you know, a step road, dirt road that meanders through abandoned farms. The village itself has about 50 people today, you know, and majority of people there subsist on livestock breeding. When you are there, it is very difficult to imagine oneself being on the polygon, as the test site is known locally, because there are no borders and there are no signs that say, hey, you are entering the test site. So you may be on the test site itself near a crater and may not even know it.
Well, that's remarkable then. So it sounds like you can just sort of walk up and go to like a crater created by a giant thermonuclear bomb then without anybody restricting you.
Yes, absolutely. And actually, you know, one of the things that happens is that people use a lot of the lands over there for livestock breeding. So sheep, goats, cows and horses go onto the territory. And you can see that, right, especially since some of the craters provide perfect watering holes. One of the things I've never done when I was here doing research in 2010 and 2011 was drive through the test site. And I did this this year for a simple reason that it is the main thoroughfare through which to get to, let's say, Karaganda. It's a much faster route to get to the city of Karaganda than to actually go around. So what I did is I drove through the test site to Semie, and then I took a train from Semie to Karaganda to sort of look at the difference in the distance. And what I found, of course, is that, yes, it's true. It's only 500 miles from Karaganda to Semie through the test site versus some nearly 800 miles or so in a 24-hour train ride to Karaganda itself. The key point here, of course, is that the road itself goes through ground zero for nuclear tests. And the safe way to drive through there is to close your windows, wear a Tyvek suit, gloves, rubber boots, and a mask. And of course, majority of people absolutely don't do that.
Well, if I could turn this to Harut Mansourian and bring you in, because you spent some time reporting on this nuclear test site. One of the places you went was this large lake called, I think it's called Lake Chagan, that was this lake that was created by a thermonuclear bomb that was put underground near a river. You and your cameraman visited this lake. What did you find there?
Well, first of all, I want to totally agree with Magdalena, with everything she said. And about the lake was created in the crater, which after the explosion after the nuclear explosion in 1965, and it was part of a plan to provide easier access to water people who were living nearby of that arid Kazakh steppe. During Soviet propaganda time, nobody told people that it was affected, that it was dangerous.
That there are high radiation levels at the lake.
Yes, and we have Geiger meters with us, and even now, like after 54 years, the level of radiation there is in some places 10 times, in some places even more higher than the base.
Okay, and yet, as I recall from your film, you found people fishing in this lake.
Yes, and people still fishing there, and it's unexplainable. We can't even imagine that. When we ask them, do you know that it could be dangerous for you? Their reaction is, please, can you take one of these fish to the laboratory to make an analyze and tell us, please, how dangerous is it? Because we were in special protective clothes there with the masks. People are still living there. They are fishing, eating their fish, selling that fish. And the main problem of this area, I guess, is not the radiation, but the lack of the information.
So the government does nothing to inform the people. It sounds like that they're fishing in a radioactive lake, that they are grazing animals on land that has been contaminated with the radiation from nuclear weapons. But Magdalena Stokowski, if I could turn this back to you, what does medical research show about sort of the dangers of living near this test? I mean, is there good medical research about what's happened to the people who live in this area?
And this is where we get into the similarities between Chernobyl and Semipalatinsk. When you get to the issue of low-dose radiation, that is the amount of radiation needed to harm you or the threshold below which we don't see effects, it is very difficult to show scientifically that low-dose radiation exposure causes particular cancers, right? Lung cancer, for example, one can get from smoking cigarettes. So teasing out where this cancer is coming from, or let's say cardiovascular problems, has been quite difficult. So one of the things that's very interesting about the Semipalatinsk nuclear test site is that there is certainly research being done by people like Yulia Siminova and Ludmila Pivina at the Semi State Medical Academy, who have shown actually that past exposure from above ground nuclear tests is actually causing effects intergenerationally, right? From one generation to the next, including, you know, variety of cancers plus cardiovascular issues plus depression, right? That all of these things are caused by radiation exposure. But not many people are doing research on current exposure levels at all. And actually, I would want to say what Harutin has said and agree with him on this, which is, yes, nobody's checking the fish. In fact, no one is checking the meat, right? So people graze animals there. Where do these animals go? Well, they go to Pavlodar, to the bazaar, to the market. They go to Semye. Yep. They go to Karaganda.
Yeah, and this is just no amazing, frankly, place. That this goes on. But Harutyun, if I could bring you into this conversation too, because in your film, in your short documentary, you interviewed some people who could just list name after name after name of people that they knew that had died of leukemia, that had died of thyroid cancer. Of course, everyone around the world knows some people that have died of cancer, but it was really remarkable the number of people that these people that you interviewed could name who died like in childhood or very early in life.
Just to add to what Magdalena said, that some people are paid about $12 monthly as compensation for living in the place or near that test site. And this is not small amount for those people, but the question is what they are paid for. It means that the area is polluted. People continue living in this area, test site, near it, and their cattle graze on this land. No one can check every cow or camel or horse. And as Magdalena said, all this meat appear in the market. So put it mildly, it's not a clever situation what is there now. And we have heard a lot of stories about how people died during those Soviet period times from cancer in Sarjal village, which is just nearby of the near the border of the test site. And the teacher Baltabek told us the story of his own. Many of his classmates were died. And the only thing is that radiation affects randomly. And he is lucky, he's still alive. but many of his friends and classmates were died. So how he explained the situation that no one cares about us. No one cared about us during the Soviet period of time. Still now, no one cares about us.
Well, Magdalena, if I could bring you, what does the Kazakh government, like, what do they say about this? How do they address this issue?
Well, one of the things that is coming up in conversations, although that has not been put into plan as of yet, is to open up parts of the test site for economic development, and that includes livestock breeding and mining. There is already mining going on a test site. For example, on a field, the Balapan field, that had something like 105 underground nuclear explosions and boreholes. Specifically, there is a coal mine that operates there. Near Ground Zero, there is also, and within the borders of the test site itself, there is a manganese mine, a gold mine, a salt mine, and a fluorite mine as well. So there's already mining going on in the region.
It seems like this would be a risky place to do underground mining if there were 300 and some underground nuclear tests.
Certainly, one could say that, but what the Institute of Radiation Safety and Ecology says in Kurchatov is that some of the areas are clean, and they do the monitoring, and don't allow testing, and don't allow mining to go on in territories that are polluted.
Well, Harut, our time grows short, but I just wanted to bring this up to the present moment today, because one of the interesting things about Kazakhstan now is that there is still Soviet military testing that happens there. Not nuclear weapons testing, but missile and rocket testing happens. Kazakhstan does have huge amounts of open space, but you interviewed some people near where the Russians are currently testing missiles and rockets. What did you find there?
It's unbelievable story, and people are living there, and sometimes parts of the rockets can fall down on their ground. While shooting, we have seen also the zigzag of the rocket on the sky. We interviewed the journalist from Uralskaya Nedelya newspaper, and he told his story, explaining how it works. Every time Kazakh government said that these lands are rented by Russians, and Russians, every question they can, Kazakh.
It sounds like there can be a lot of pollution from when these rockets crash sometimes, especially from the rocket fuel. And I know that you documented several different cases of potential birth defects and other diseases there as well. But I'm sorry, we're out of time for this edition of Global Journalist. We're going to have to leave it there. Global Journalist is a production of the Reynolds Journalism Institute at the Missouri School of Journalism and KBIA, Mid-Missouri Public Radio. Many thanks to Tatiana Yakubovich, Alex Nadkovich, Harut Mansourian, and Magdalena Stokowski. Our producer this week is Seth Bodine. Megan Smaltz is visual editor. Aaron Hay is audio engineer. Travis McMillan is our director. For all of us at Global Journalist, I'm Jason McClure. Thanks for tuning in.